What color is your lightsaber?
Mine? It's like a burgundy.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
J.S. Mill called it dead dogma, right? He was like, we can't have dead dogma, because you'll be like, well, you can't say the N-word, can't say the N-word, can't say the N-word. And after a while, we'll all be like, well, why not? And someone saying the N-word actually gives us the opportunity to reiterate why it's important, right? And so, like, hateful speech can actually remind us what our values are.
Okay, here we go. Fourth episode of Reverbs, December 29th. Thursday evening. My name's Blake Mannion. I will be hosting tonight. I have sitting here next to me, John Kelly. And up in Lafayette, we have John Anderson.
Hey guys.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing good.
This is episode 4. Sorry, let me ask you how you're doing and cut you off.
I'm doing great, Blake. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're doing, and I'm good too. Thanks.
We're doing a little house switch tonight, so pardon me and my flubs. I'm gonna do the best I can here. So episode 4 tonight, we're gonna talk about nuclear weapons and free speech. If you remember, we cover the First Amendment this month, First Amendment month, December. So yeah, we're going to kick it off with segment 1, nukes for days. Basically, our concern today is the latest tweet by Donald Trump, and I'm going to quote it real quick. The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such times as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes. So this is kind of what we're going to base our first segment around today, is Donald Trump's tweet about nuclear weapons and why that should be of a concern to the entire world. Anybody want to start off? Comments, concerns with this quote right off the bat? Why does this concern us?
Nukes scare me. I'm freaking afraid of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, well... what were you saying, Kelly? We have enough nuclear weapons to blow the world over how many times?
I think it's around 130.
Yeah, that's pretty terrible.
So we could...
To do it once is enough. To do it 130 times seems a bit extreme. So when you have the commander-in-chief saying that he wants to continue to expand nuclear weapons, I guess the question becomes why you would want to do that.
Well, and especially after it's been 40 years of persistent de-escalation and reduction, de-escalation in tensions and reduction in nuclear arms between us, the Russians, and everybody else. Well, minus like North Korea and those shitheads.
Right.
But, you know, part of the New START Treaty in 2010, we're already modernizing our nuclear weapons to the tone of $1 trillion, and apparently the incoming commander-in-chief wants to expand that.
I have a quote from Trump back in April. He said, I would like to see a nuclear-free world. Will that happen? Question mark. Chances are extremely small that will happen. So I think that's something that an ideal world is wonderful, but I think it's not going to happen very easily. He said that in April, and it makes me wonder if he's just completely out of date with the last 40 years, like you were saying, of us trying to deconstruct our nuclear arsenal.
I think it's pretty obvious that he has not spent the last 40 years trying to understand U.S. nuclear policy. I think that's pretty freaking clear. He obviously doesn't understand the first thing about nuclear weapons, right? Nuclear weapons exist the way that we have, quote, fought with them over the last, since 1945, is it's deterrence. Nuclear weapons exist so that they are not to be used. And so expanding our arsenal is antithetical to that goal, right? That's freaking crazy. Unless you want to do a, like, Ronald Reagan, we're going to outspend them, blah, 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 blah. But then you still have a bunch of nuclear weapons lying around. And we have seen that that's a really, really terrible idea because we forget about them. And then the forces decay.
Right, but It seems like, though, from his quote, that he is genuinely maybe interested in a nuclear-free world, right? So, like, how do we educate him that that might be possible?
Hop on Twitter. 140 characters or less. Nukes are bad. So bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question, Blake. And, you know, what you get out of it is, I think, this kind of hopeful... It's a weird combination, right, coming from Trump. Because you have this kind of hopeful isolationism that comes out. We're saying that, oh, yeah, you know, it'd be utopia without nuclear weapons, and it'd be great to get there. And then in the same vein, he's saying we absolutely need to continue to grow our nuclear capabilities.
Right.
Which is really only a challenge at this point to Russia.
So it's interesting that you say that. And that's good. Not to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
And we're kind of jumping ahead here. We're going to get to this in a minute about Russia and Putin's most recent moves with Kaliningrad. But before we go there, some people are saying that his tweet was a response to what Russia and Putin has been doing with their nuclear arsenal and moving those missiles that are capable of installing those nuclear warheads on them. So some are saying that Trump responded with this tweet in a sense to show some his what is it, machismo? Is that what they call it?
Machismo.
So, you know, towards Vladimir Putin, and it's probably an empty threat, but he felt like he needed to say something.
I think that's. I think this goes to a larger question about Trump. And you can see this in a vein in the way he has done the campaign and now the way he's doing foreign policy, which is, you know, was taking the call with the leader of Taiwan a brilliant strategic move to put the Chinese off balance? Or did he just not know that that was a thing? Mm-hmm. And is he saying one thing about nuclear weapons and then saying another thing about nuclear weapons to keep countries off balance so that he is better able to maneuver in the world? Or is he just like tweeting things that he decides is in his brain that day? And right. So like, I think that this is one of the really interesting questions going forward and the really pivotal questions going forward about the Trump administration is he impulsive and ignorant, or is he a brilliant strategist? And I'm going with the former right now. But like,
right.
What do you guys think?
Well, I think that what he said wasn't very clear. Like, if he wants to, for example, what an important number that everybody needs to know. And also, we should mention that there are more countries in the world than just the United States and Russia that have nuclear capabilities. Those countries are Pakistan, India, Britain, France, North Korea, Israel, China, and then Russia and the United States. But here's the thing is, his on deployment right now, the United States, and deployment means missiles, so warheads on ballistic missiles, and...
So those are warheads
that aircraft, basically, yeah, like equipped, ready to launch, at the ready position. That's what deployment means. And so the United States has nuclear warheads on deployment, 1,367, and Russia's at 1,796. That's a lot of nukes, first of all, and those are the amount of like activated missiles ready to launch from submarine, land, air, sea, you name it. And those are huge numbers, and I don't know if he just hasn't read those numbers. If you look at the stockpile count, the United States has 4,571 and Russia has 4,500. And that doesn't even include the total number that is in line for becoming disassembled, I guess is how you would say it. But I just feel like Trump doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
I would be very curious to know if like he knew those numbers or had any inkling of those numbers or had any way of even breaking down the difference between like deployed and stockpiled weapons. I think these are all like pretty interesting, and they've become pretty pivotal questions, right? And so, I don't know. I think, like, why do you have nuclear weapons, right? You don't have them to use them because then the world's over. So you have them so that other countries won't fuck with you, basically. We have seen that, you know, countries like the UK, I don't know what their nuclear count is, but they have one leg of our triad. So we have planes,
Right.
planes, submarines, and and missiles, land-based missiles, right? Are how we fire missiles. They just have the Trident submarines. Their deterrence is fine. China, I think, has 300 warheads in total compared to our 1,000 deployed forces,
One
and
thousand
they have
seven, six,
deterrence.
seven.
Yeah. So I think if you're gonna have nuclear weapons, it's a lot. You don't have to have very many to have deterrence to accomplish the goal, right? And then you can take all those down and spend it on stuff that's way better. Like, even if you wanted to still spend it on the military, we could pay for a lot of veterans' healthcare by decreasing the nuclear arsenal in a huge way. And so if Trump was really serious about like leading the world on nuclear weapons, he would unilaterally reduce the stockpile of nuclear weapons in the US on day one, just as a fig leaf to the world to say we're serious about this. And the reason is because we have enough nuclear weapons to do that anyways and maintain all of the objectives that we want to maintain. And so it just seems ludicrous that we would expand. It's just whose nuclear dick is bigger, seems to me.
Seems no way. You mean Trump would make that argument?
His nukes have small hands.
And I think you touch on really the key point about it, which is kind of that the pissing contest, the who's got the bigger dick contest, right? The numbers matter to a guy like Trump. They always
It's true,
have.
numbers do matter.
You know, it's very clear from if you look at his life, that he's very concerned with numbers. He's concerned about winning. He's concerned about making the most. He's concerned about being the best salesman. You know, all of these things play into his character, and I think that they will definitely play a big role in how he thinks about
We should
these
tell him it's like
in a lot
golf.
of
Big
trouble.
numbers. Big numbers are losing.
That's an
Zero.
interesting concept. We just got to get him to listen to this podcast.
Nukes are like golf.
Well, so let's move on to what Putin's recently done in Russia. Basically, what has happened recently, Russia moved nuclear capable, I'm going to get this wrong, but Iskander-M missiles. Did I say that right?
Oh, I don't know.
Into the Kaliningrad territory bordering Poland and Lithuania. So those missiles are basically, they're missiles that you can mount a nuclear warhead on them, and they can reach targets up to 450 miles away. So, for example, because they're in this territory of Kaliningrad, which is owned by Russia, it's a really bizarre spot if you look at it on a map. It's really an unreal place to move your nuclear arsenal. You can hit Berlin from Kaliningrad with a nuke. So, I mean, maybe Trump is just trying to be big words right now and scare Russia, but I think he also might be antagonizing them a little bit, which is scary.
Yeah, you know, it was, I was, thinking about, what was I listening to last night? Something about World War II. And it seemed interesting to me that, like, the only man that Stalin ever trusted was Hitler. And that really screwed him up when Hitler betrayed the ceasefire or the non-aggression pact. And I feel like the relationship in a lot of ways are similar to Putin and Trump, two strong men who seem to get along. But I'm waiting for this thing to melt down really quickly, and I'm concerned about what that looks like when it does.
Yeah,
I mean, what you're looking at with the movement of nuclear weapons back into Leningrad is almost like a reboot of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Right? That area is Russia's only warm water ocean port that they have, so it's a very important spot to the Russian Federation.
Not if you count Crimea now.
But that's, yeah, it's not technically the same type. Since you have to go through the straits out into the Mediterranean, eventually you get.
Right.
Oh, wait, no, that's just in the Black Sea, so never mind. Yeah, it's not technically a warm oceanic port, like I was getting at.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Putin is flexing his power in Eastern Europe, which has some of our allies very scared about what's going to happen over the next 3 or 4 years. If the U.S. takes a strong stance against any type of aggression towards Russia, you could see large land grabs in Eastern Europe, with Putin feeling emboldened by these moves that he's doing right now.
Oh, hell yeah.
What's interesting about it is that it's almost like Trump has taken kind of an appeasement towards Russia during his campaign about campaigning that Hillary Clinton would bring us closer to war with Russia,
asking for them to hack her emails, that's treasonous.
Right. Well, I mean, we're not getting into that right now, but I think that then we have this other issue of bolstering and making our nuclear armament stronger and larger, which is almost the exact opposite of somebody who would appease a growing nuclear power would do.
Right.
So it's almost like he's trying to play both sides, appeasing Russia, saying the aggression right now is fine, but at the same time, you know, we're still watching our asses, you know, by building more.
And and that's assuming that he's connecting these two things, right? Like, again, is he strategically brilliant and is like, I'm gonna play them on one hand and like, you know, shake their hand on the other? Or, like, is he just deciding one morning that he wants to tweet about nuclear weapons?
Right, or, like, depending on what he had for dinner last night.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Fix his mood.
And, yeah, but getting back to Eastern Europe, if I was those countries, I would be freaking out right now.
Well, I don't know if you guys have heard about this. This is something else I recently discovered. This was published May 12th, 2016 by CNN Politics, but the title of this article says U.S. launches long-awaited European missile defense shield, and I guess...
Is this the one in Poland?
What's that?
Is this the one in Poland?
Romania.
Oh.
But yeah, ground-based missile defense system in Romania is this NATO-sponsored project, I believe.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, pretty interesting, and so I don't know what the progress of that is right now, but I would imagine that they've been putting a lot of work into that.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about this, so like in the tic-tac-toe that is nuclear policy, which Trump obviously doesn't understand, defense is really destabilizing, right? Because
hold on, I got a quick question. Has anybody seen Donald Trump eat?
No, I don't think he eats in front of people. I think that's a thing, isn't it, with him?
He's spoon-fed? Sorry, I interrupted you, my bad. What were you saying?
Anyways, so the way the nuclear strategy has worked is, well, I can blow your shit up as much as you can blow my shit up, so like, let's not. That's basically deterrence.
It's mad, right? It's mutually assured destruction.
Yep.
You know, you line your nukes up just to the point where they could almost hit your cities or can hit your cities, and then say, well, it's your move next. If you want to launch some, we'll launch them too.
And so the interesting thing is that's actually proven to be really stable, right? Like, we have not had a major state war since 1945. And so the bad thing
And for the people who argue against deterrence, I mean, really, nuclear weapons have only been used on people twice by the U.S.
And just the first time. And we were like, that was not a good decision.
Right. Nobody else in the world has used them on citizens. We've had tests in uninhabited places.
Most of those tests are now banned also, which we'll see if we renege on that. But if you factor in defense into the calculation, which would be like a missile shield, right? Then you might say, okay, well, I'm Putin and I'm sitting here and I've got intelligence that the United States in 5 years will have the capability of shooting down all nuclear weapons, all nuclear missiles, right? So then I say, well, the clock is ticking for me to shut this down in the next 5 years. If you get to, you know, year 4.99 and you haven't solved that problem yet, you might say, well, I'm going to launch all my missiles before they become completely obsolete. And so bringing defense into this equation can oxymoronically actually be really destabilizing. And,
interesting.
And so that is one of the things that makes nuclear weapons so scary and why you need to pay a lot of attention to it, Mr. President, because it is really complicated, and if you get it wrong, we all die.
Now, yeah. And it actually, and Blake, sorry to interrupt you, but what John is describing, this kind of buildup offensively and kind of a technological battle to see who's going to be coming out ahead, is exactly what happened with that 2016 article you're talking about from CNN Politics. That's a direct response by the U.S. after the invasion of Crimea.
Yeah.
Is putting missiles in Romania to shoot down nuclear weapons that could be launched at Berlin or Paris.
And I might be making this up. We'll have to check it in the show notes. But I think part of the why we were able to get the New START Treaty through was because we stopped the missile shield we were planning in Poland.
Interesting.
And so that was a bargaining chip that we used. And so you can actually threaten the defense as a bargaining chip, right? And so these things get crazy. I mean, this is one of the game theory actually came out of how to understand nuclear strategy, because you cannot, when you're dealing with like military strategy, you're like, okay, well, how is this going to play out? It's pretty easy. Let's just go back and see what happened before. But you cannot do that with nuclear weapons because we've never seen a nuclear war. And mm-hmm. so you have to just game these things out in your head. And that's actually where the whole field of game theory developed. And so it is stupid complicated. And one of the things that makes it really difficult to understand is it's very counterintuitive. You wouldn't think that defense would be destabilizing, and you wouldn't think that offense would be a way for peace, but that's
what however, though, that's kind of an aggressive defensive move, whereas arming a naval vessel with a laser anti-missile weapon mm-hmm. to shoot down these things, and then those are stationed in international waters, that's a lot less threatening than setting up an anti-missile defense system right on somebody's border.
That's good.
And so that's really kind of an aggressive defense tactic.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, yeah, maybe we should, I know we have this capability, I've read about it, and so maybe we should focus on these defense tactics elsewhere that aren't so aggravating.
I would like the U.S. to focus on reducing the stockpile of nuclear weapons.
I'm all about laser beams right now. I think we're really close to creating a lightsaber, too. And I think it's going to have something to do with Tesla.
Sign me up. Know it. What color is your lightsaber?
Mine? It's like a burgundy.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
Kelly?
Yeah.
Haven't thought that one all the way through.
No.
What color I would go with. Aren't there, like, there's different descriptions if you get into Star
you
Wars.
You can do what you want.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but no, it says a lot about you.
Yeah, I know, right? It's one of my get-to-know-you questions, actually.
Burgundy's like close astrology, to red. Blake's actually a Sith. That's
hey, close to burgundy. No. Chaotic neutral, all right? Chaotic neutral.
You know what I would do is I would take down all nuclear weapons with my lightsaber if I could.
Yeah, definitely.
But John, I think that you're right that a good step forward would be to advise people to start discontinuing the nuclear program and disarming bombs and making our stockpile smaller.
So yeah, is this practical? Yeah. I mean, how do we do this? Is this something?
So I think
you think this is a
like right now zero is not practical, but smaller is practical, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
I mean, get down to the amount that you can blow the Earth up twice.
Yeah,
perfect.
Cool.
Great.
Go for yeah. I mean, right. Like
right. That,
I think.
That works.
What if half those nukes don't activate? Then we're going to need like 500 more or something, right?
Well, that's why you do it twice. So that if the one time doesn't work, you can... Yeah.
Okay, got
there
it.
There you go.
Maybe we should just make sure we have competent engineers, which, by the way, I think we do.
I don't know. Watch that John Oliver video. You might be a little concerned.
We got to put that up on the action notes for sure. Or the reading lists.
Yes. The goal of U.S. nuclear strategy in the short term should be reduce the stockpile as much as possible while maintaining deterrence. And so I think that it might be a little risky, but you can basically do that with like two submarines. And so I think that if the U.S. really made some bold act, I think this would be, the U.S. is best when we have moral leadership, right? Like we had that after World War II. And I think that one of the ways, and we're not doing very well on that right now. Barack Obama got a peace prize for just like existing because the world wanted that. And so I think that this is a great opportunity for the U.S. to regain the moral high ground, which is we go out and we say, we understand all of this nuclear deterrence and how like we got to match arsenals with the Russians and whatever. But we have enough faith in our capabilities that we're going to dramatically drop our nuclear arsenal because we believe that it is that important. And I think that that moral leadership would accrue to more things than just nuclear weapons. I think that we would be able to go out and say, and, you know, make more forceful arguments in the UN for human rights. Because we can say, look, we are actually decreasing our nuclear arsenal by 50%. What are you doing? And I think that would be, I think that would really rebalance American strategic moral leadership in a positive direction. I think that'd be huge.
Right. And I mean, it goes back to our discussion in our first podcast, which is what's America's real role as a global leader,
right?
And what should be the most important aspects of foreign power and democracy that should be focused on. When you bring the nuclear armament into it, it really, we've obviously, it's proven that it bumps up the stakes a lot. And the stuff that Trump has said, the anti-UN stuff, especially some of his threats when he was campaigning to, you know, defund the defense of some of our key allies, unless they started paying us more money to help with our military costs.
Hey, nice country. Shame if something were to happen to it.
Right, right. I mean, we're not going to have any type of leadership in the UN as far as the US goes in the next 4 years.
Oh, clearly. No. There's, we'll be, I mean, I hope it,
it's a, it's a, it's nice to think about. I know that we've discussed it multiple times outside of this idea of the US taking kind of more of a moral high ground and being leaders in the world, not just being bullies or cops in the world, or some kind of gun for hire mercenary group like it seems like Trump kind of wants our military to be at times.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to think about, in real terms, what's going to happen over the next 4 years with Trump. And if his speeches that really relate to a lot of isolationism and to a lot of anti-global power connections comes true, then the UN is going to be a force that's going to be greatly weakened over the next 4 years without a lot of U.S. support.
Yeah.
And we get into a whole further conversation of, are we blowing, you know, 60 years worth of close international ties?
Fuck yeah, we are.
In the name of
Trump Industries.
And I mean, in the name of saying that the U.S. Shouldn't care about other global powers, shouldn't care about our allies as much, and we need to focus on what's best for us first.
I think what Trump is saying is we shouldn't care about them unless there is a direct and evident benefit for us. And with
or threat. Sometimes it seems that he wouldn't be opposed to intervention if it was really going to destabilize certain areas.
I think
economy.
But it's very, like, transactional, right? Like, I think it's, we will do A if you give us B. And the unfortunate thing about that is, you know, the great Atlantic Alliance between Britain and the U.S. is built on trust, right? Like, primarily. It's not, there is not a binding legal document that means that Britain follows us into Iraq, even though it's a terrible idea. And we make sure that there's no way that they don't make it through World War II. You know, like, and this has been... I think a net positive in the world, although we'll have to do a whole podcast on that. But
yeah, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there, but like, you know, I think I am for moving the Atlantic global order forward, not backward, because I think backward means World War One and Two, and I think forward means like Mars, and Mars sounds like more fun.
So. We should probably move on to our next segment, but I have a question because I'm not very familiar with this, but how easy would it be for Trump to launch one of these nuclear warhead missiles? How easy is that?
It's 6 minutes easy.
Like, he can just do it? He doesn't have to get
confirmation
from anyone?
So, during the Cold War, and we still operate with the same Cold War rules that we have not changed these rules unless, like, there is some super secret something or other, but literally nobody knows about this if it's a thing. It was that we had something on order of 6 minutes to determine if the blimp on the radar was a weather blimp or a nuclear strike designed to cripple the United States from Russia. So... And if they got off that first strike, it could be that they completely annihilate us before we even get anything off the ground, right? So we had 6 minutes to make that determination. So we made it really, 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 really easy for the president to launch weapons so that they could retaliate against Russia, so that there was a credible deterrent threat against a first strike. The thing is there's no longer a credible first strike threat, but we can still launch them in 6 minutes. And literally, he doesn't have to check with Congress. He doesn't have to check with anybody. He can say, pull out the nuclear... Blake, do you know the nuclear football?
The nuclear football?
Yes.
Have
you heard
no,
this term?
No.
Okay, so there's a dude who follows the president around wherever he goes with a briefcase... chained to him, basically. That briefcase is how you launch nuclear weapons. And so Trump could say, I'm hungry, and turkey, fried turkey sounds awesome, let's bring out the nuclear arsenal. And 6 minutes later, we have annihilated turkey. It's literally that easy. And there is no one who can tell him no, other than like some fucking hero in a silo somewhere. Like, literally, we're depending on the private out there turning the key, being like, are we sure we want to do this? And like, I don't want to.
Which causes a whole bunch of issues right there.
Right.
I'm not going to jump the gun and say that Trump's going to start a nuclear holocaust, you know, by shooting off a bunch of missiles because he got insulted on Twitter at 2 a.m. or something. I'm not going to jump the gun. I think that he's surrounding himself by people that might be isolationist, but I really don't think that he will fly off the handle that easy when it comes to that. But
the point is that he could.
Nuclear weapons, it's, you have to consider that with anybody who has their hand on the button.
Exactly.
And it's crazy that one person has that much power.
It's nuts. Mm-hmm. Especially with the Cold War being over. Well, sort of over. We thought it was over.
We thought it was over.
If there's no more credible first strike problems, then yeah, like, maybe you should have to check with, like, you know, the Speaker of the House. Let's two dudes, right? Instead of one right now. But it is literally, it is... easier to launch nuclear weapons than it is to start a war in America.
Right, right.
And it's pretty, as we've seen, it's rather easy to do that.
Does that answer your question, Blake?
It does.
Yeah.
Thank you. So,
point is, be afraid.
Yeah.
Enough talk about nukes.
It's kind of depressing. And Not that this next segment's going to be a whole lot less depressing.
I think we're going to have a lot of that in 2017.
So let's move on to free speech.
Oh, it fucking better be not as depressing.
Oh, dude, free I speech. Think 20... I predictions for 2017, I think it's going to be more depressing.
Oh, boy.
I hate to be a total cloud of...
Debbie Downer?
Yeah, but, like, I don't think 2017 is going to be better.
Everybody should we read the First Amendment?
Yeah, let's read the First Amendment.
All right, the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people to peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. All right, so moving on with free speech here, leave the nukes behind. Why are we talking about free speech, and why is it this on our radar for this podcast?
I think I'll jump in first. So, personally, I think that this is the most important part of the First Amendment.
Sure.
Free speech really predetermines all that other stuff that's in there, I think. Freedom of religion, press, freedom to assemble, all comes from the basic right of freedom of speech, freedom to express yourself without the federal government saying you can't do that.
Sure.
You know, and obviously there are restrictions, some restrictions that have been put on it. And I think there's an interesting conversation going on around the U.S. today about what really is free speech, what constitutes free speech, what should or should not be protected. You have these ideas of safe spaces to protect people from certain types of speech. Sure. Whether or not that's a good idea, I'd like to hear you guys' opinion on that.
Are you talking about like low First Amendment value speech? Like what they classify as being defamation, commercial advertising, true threats, fighting words, obscenity, like stuff like that. Like, so like you can work for the government and have access to classified information, but you're not allowed to like release that classified information. You're talking about
words? I mean, in a way, yes. I think it's more of offensive speech is what I was kind of getting at. And I think that's a bigger conversation today around most circles. It's not so much the, oh, yeah, of course, you know, obscenity shouldn't be, you know, said, or, you know, you shouldn't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of accepted
bomb societal on an airplane.
Stuff. Bomb on an airplane.
It's a bad idea.
Yeah, don't say that.
No.
But I mean, yeah, I think that we are talking about the most fundamental right that we have when looking at the Constitution is our freedom of speech. And I'm a big adherent to saying that there's almost no restriction to it besides kind of the public health stuff that we were speaking of just then, you know, not making people not riot in a theater when you yell fire, stuff like that. Just about everything else, I think, is protected by the First Amendment. What do you think, John?
Well, I would like to know, I'm interested in where your line is, Kelly. Like, are you one of those, like, super free speech, like, use free speech to fight free speech, all speech should be allowed, blah, 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 blah? Or, like, so, for instance...
Yeah, I don't know what you mean by use free speech to fight... free speech.
What?
I'm not sure what you mean by use free speech to fight free speech.
So, or to use speech to fight speech. So what you would say is like, well, we should ban fake news, right? But the problem is like, how do you do that? And there's all kinds of line drawing problems and blah, blah, blah. And so the retort to that is, well, no, the reason we have speech is so that we have a marketplace of ideas, right? And so that we have to go out and we have to argue about things. And so you can't ban free speech the way to or you can't ban fake news. The way to deal with fake news is you have to have a bunch of people come out and say, no, that's not right. That's not right. Hear what the truth is. And so the truth is determined by the conversation, or the truth is determined by, like, there are some lines we could draw, right? So, like, you could say, well, you know, I mean, literally, like, opening up the libel laws so that fake news isn't a thing. You have to, like, be accurate. You know, like, where, what, it, do you have any clear lines on that?
Of what I think should be restricted free speech?
Like, what is the government's ability to restrict free speech? Like, under what circumstances can governments restrict free speech? Or can the U.S. government restrict free speech?
I think it's practically nothing. So, I mean, you can't restrict words or use of phrases if it offends certain people. You can't stop the use of people publishing certain articles if they think that it's fake. I mean, that goes back to freedom of the press, I think, more than it does to freedom of speech. It's hard to draw a line because I think you start with a very slippery slope when you start allowing people to not use certain types of speech, right? Like, it'd be easy to say, oh, you know, we don't want certain types of hateful words to be said by people, right? In certain phrases, like, the, you know, using the N-word, right? Just ban it outright. You can't do that.
Right.
You know, as much as it hurts African Americans and people that care about how people feel, you know, it violates, I think, your most basic right, if you want to say that word. And two, it leads to further problems of if you ban certain speeches, those ideas that sit behind that speech will then never be discussed, even though people still feel them. Right. So racist terms, racist sentiments will still be there mm-hmm. under the guise of us just not talking about it. It's like sweeping it under the rug.
It becomes, J.S. Mill called it dead dogma, right? He was like, mm-hmm. we can't have dead dogma because you'll be like, well, you can't say the N-word, can't say the N-word, can't say the N-word. And after a while, we'll all be like, well, why not? And the someone saying the N-word actually gives us the opportunity to reiterate why it's important, right? And so, like, hateful speech can actually remind us what our values are.
Right, and that's why I say that it's very hard to say that there should be a line to stop any type of speech.
Right. What about, like,
I mean, this is more freedom of the press, I guess, related. One example that would, I think, should bring up some concern, and we may have mentioned this on a previous podcast, but Melania Trump suing the Daily Mail online, for example, for basically, I guess, a form of defamation and slander. I mean, that's more of relates to the media, but it's still a form of speech, right? That should be a big concern for many people.
So yeah,
they know that
they can be sued for something that they think.
Right, and that's one of the big concerns that we have about journalism today, right, is that you can't necessarily ban journalism, but you can make it too expensive to do. And
right.
So that's what we're, I think, really worried about under the Trump administration for journalism in particular, which is why you should don't pay for news. It's important.
Right.
But I think, like, so, okay, what that has is it has what they call a chilling effect on speech, or I mean on the press, where, like, if you do that, you don't necessarily have to do it again for it to have a negative effect. And so I think the interesting thing for this conversation is, do we see similar chilling effect things happening in terms of speech? And I think we actually do. Trump went after one of those, he went after a local union boss who I believe he came out and said, well, the carrier, I think he criticized the carrier deal. I don't want to get exactly wrong what he said. But Trump came out and attacked him personally. And that's, mm-hmm. I mean, granted, yeah, the guy was being political, but, like, you're kind of punching below your weight a little bit if you're the president of the United States and you're going after a local union boss. And so that, and especially in the age of social media, that can bring down a whole torrent of problems on somebody's head. And so I am concerned we're going to see similar chilling effects with free speech, which is exactly why we have to keep doing that, right? Like, people might say, well, you know, now that Trump has the NSA, like, should you censor yourself more on the internet about what you say, or more in text messaging? And no, you should do the opposite of that. You should go as hard as you can. Yep. Because yep. You declare the principle immediately, forcefully, and at the very beginning. You say, no, my voice will not be silenced at all. And if you're going to come for it, you're going to have to come for it hard. And I think that is how we have to meet the new administration on January 1st. We should all be very vocal about how we're feeling about things.
So your fear is that the government already has, they can limit context of speech, but not the content of speech, right? So is your concern that they're going to expand this to kind of...
more the content?
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that they're going to... Do you think the government will actually...
No, I think what they're going to do is... I don't think that there will be a law. I don't think that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are going to pass a law that Trump will sign. So this is a form of the bully pulpit, right? Which is, the president can't make laws, but the president can go out and make a primetime speech that will then piss off a lot of people, and they'll call their congresspeople, who will then pass a law, right? That's how the bully pulpit works. And we could see the bully pulpit turned on individual citizens for speaking out against the government, not against congresspeople or elected officials. And that's scary, because the power is so disproportionate that it can have a chilling effect. So, like, I don't think that it will be a legal thing, but I guarantee you this is going to happen.
But what we need to watch is legal ramifications from the federal government, or the attorney general going after somebody for libel speech, or along those lines. I mean, though it's kind of uncouth and frowned upon for the president to, you know, not be above petty politics, he has every right to stand there and argue with personal citizens if he wants to. As bad as it sounds, and as much as it would make him look less presidential and make people question his ability to lead properly, he has every right to do it.
He has the right under the First Amendment, like the rest of us.
Right, and that's exactly right. If he starts wielding power from the bully pulpit and stopping parts of speech. So, like, when he said he was going to open up libel laws to make it easier to sue people who slandered you, if he continued along something along those lines and, you know, got the Congress of the United States, which I agree, John, I think it's very unlikely that Ryan or McConnell would ever pass anything like that in the House or the Senate.
No, because it's unconstitutional, basically.
Oh, it's so unconstitutional that it's... almost mind-boggling to think it would happen.
I
think that as far as First Amendment rights go, this may not be the biggest one that we have to be concerned about necessarily Trump really messing with, compared to assembly and petitioning.
I think there's
religion, potentially. We haven't got to that yet. But I mean, speech itself, I think, is such a fundamental right in the United States that even with some of the very totalitarian leaning views of Trump, it's probably safe. And there would be huge outcry from both outsides.
I think it's safe legally.
Sorry, say that again?
I think it's safe legally. Relatively safe legally, but I do think that the norm of free speech is going to come under attack. And that is the norm of being able to talk truth to power. Like, what happens when there's the White House Correspondents' Dinner and some comedian pulls a move like Stephen Colbert did on George Bush and was basically like, you're a terrible human being and I'm going to tell you why that is in jokes to your face. And go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say, no, I think Trump would probably drop a nuke on him.
Right, exactly. Like, I think it's going to be, and so I think that the ability of Americans to speak truth to power is going to be under attack, and that is something that we're going to have to be really watchful. I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, where we need checks and balances in speech. I think this was on like the second podcast. We can't put in legal checks, but we can put in like societal checks. And so right now, the American people need to be acting as a check on our government in terms of free speech, I think. I think that is something that we're going to have to really focus on going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the action section. So make sure you speak your mind.
Yeah, don't get soft.
Say shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just say stuff. You see something. See something, report something, right?
I mean, but within reason.
Right, but I mean, in all seriousness, you know, unless there's some kind of legal change, you know, they'll have the correspondence dinner, but Trump will bring in somebody who won't grill him. So he won't bring in a Stephen Colbert, you know?
Was SOPA and PIPA a form of perhaps... a change in our freedom of speech that was trying to get passed by corporations? That had to do with net neutrality, right?
Sort of. I think that we got that. It was a little bit more nuanced. Do you want to explain net neutrality real quick?
Net neutrality, from my understanding, and help me out here, guys, because I'm sure I might miss a few things, but is the concept that the internet information and speed should be equally distributed among everybody, and that providers aren't allowed to give better or worse service or information to their customers.
Right. So basically, like, if I decided that I wanted to go out and challenge Amazon, right, and I want to be the new Amazon, I could make a deal with if net neutrality didn't exist, I could make a deal with Comcast and say, hey, Comcast, make my website twice as fast as their website, and I'll give you 50% of my earnings or whatever. And so that would give you an undue competitive advantage against Amazon because you would have a better website speed, right? Now, someone's probably not going to come in and challenge Amazon, but it is really hard for me, like random blogger, to actually be successful if my blog is super slowed down compared to the New York Times, right? So that becomes a really big problem. And that's one of the reasons why, like, the internet is basically more democratic than democracy, because everybody's website, even if it's your crazy uncle's, loads at the same speed. SOPA and PIPA, and that was a little different. And Blake, I think I got this wrong when we were doing our prep. But SOPA and PIPA are more about copyright infringement.
Yeah, they are. It's less about free speech.
Yeah, okay. It has to do with that, but it's more about copyright infringement. It's about who owns what on the internet. But it was a really, really good example of advocacy on the internet. Websites like Wikipedia shut down for the day.
Yeah, I remember that.
And everybody lost their minds, and people who wrote that bill were running away from it within a day. And so it's a really, really good example of online speech advocacy.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I was trying to figure out the relationship between the two, but that clarifies it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Perfect. Sorry about that.
No, that's great. And that John Oliver video on net neutrality is so good.
It's a good primer. Yeah. if you care about net neutrality, watch if you don't know what it is either, watch the John Oliver thing on it. It's like 13 minutes. It's a quick one.
So what do you guys suggest? What do we do to protect our freedom of speech as these things perhaps arise in the Trump presidency?
Well, so we went over some of it, which was like just basically using it. I think the thing that we haven't gone over that's really important is you have to protect others' rights to free speech, even if you don't like that speech. Especially if you don't like that speech. I remember my mom cut out an editorial from this crazy person and gave it to me before school one time. And I brought it in and we were all passing it around before Mr. Mott's class and making fun of this person and blah, 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 blah. And I pointed it out to Mr. Mott and he was like, yeah, that is a monument to free speech, isn't it? And like was not having it with us making fun of this person. And it always stuck out to me because I was like, why doesn't he think this is funny? And then I was like, oh, that's a really good lesson, which is the speech that you dislike the most is the speech that you have to protect the most. And so I think we don't like it, but Trump has a right to free speech. We don't like it, but the KKK has a right to free speech. We don't like it, but Breitbart has a right to exist. The thing that the responsibility that we have is to be as vocal and as forceful about our ideas. And so in the marketplace of ideas, our ideas went out. That's our responsibility. It's to protect free speech by advocating for it as forcefully as possible.
And practicing some tolerance at the same time.
And practicing some tolerance, yes. As Voltaire said, I completely disagree with you, but I will defend your right to speech to my death. Which was his was much more eloquent. But that was a paraphrasing. But yeah, that encapsulates free speech for America.
You said Voltaire wrote that?
Yeah, Voltaire. The Frenchman.
If you guys ever have time, go rent the Candide musical and watch that with a glass of wine or scotch. That is great.
I haven't seen that in years. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I think that about wraps it up for the day.
If we get to Candide, we win the podcast game.
Right, yeah. If we can only make it there.
It's like the Wikipedia game.
You guys got any closing notes?
Fuck yeah, free speech.
Right.
Should we all say one thing to get our free speech on?
Should we say something offensive?
Oh, gosh. All right, well, that is going to wrap it up for us this evening. Thank you for listening to another episode of Reverbs. We'll see you next time.
Reverbs.
And cut.